Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
And now I would like to introduce our main speaker, Chief from Santa Ana.
God, what a group.
How does this sound, Doc? Can I stand straight and talk okay?
Yeah.
All right. Let me have a little double shot here before we get going. My name is Chief, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to clarify that. I'm not in the Navy. I'm Cherokee Indian. How many of you guys from the Holy Land of Oklahoma? None of you, huh? You wouldn't have made it anyway after that beating you got. But anyway, this is where it all began, San Diego, some 33 years ago, down at Chula Vista. And I always get a kick out of coming to San Diego to talk because it gives me something to lead into what I'm going to say. And we were a group about like this, just about like this. God, you're young, for Christ's sake. When you get my age, every damn thing is young. However, I went to my first AA meeting. I like to kick this off like this because it kind of settles you in just a little bit. Some 33 years ago, and I was 29 years old, about the comparable age you'd probably be in here, somewhere near it. And Wyand had been kicking my ass around National City and the South Bay for a long time. And I don't even know why in the hell I went, to tell you the truth about it, unless it was to get my wife off my back and a few employers. But I'll tell you how it happened. It was on a Monday morning or something like that. I'm not really sure what day it was, but I'd been out on the street trying to hustle a little Mickey of wine. I'd been drunk for about 3 months on that stuff, so you can imagine what I looked like. The hairstyle in those days was a ducktail, slick Vaseline kind of thing, and they didn't know what the hell a dry haircut looked like. But my hair was about that long, which was a little bit out of style. And I was kind of foraging, I guess you'd say, trying to find a live one on the street there to get me a Mickey to get moving with. And I heard a voice way up the street that called my name. And if you was a hustler like me, anybody that calls your name, you had them. If you was a good hustler. But this fellow that called my name was up sweeping the sidewalk off it in his barbershop. And I recognized him from a distance. I could recognize him. I couldn't see him close because I've worn glasses all my life, but if you've worn glasses and been on the junks like I have, you don't know where in the hell they are. I had them fished out from Oceanside to El Cajon to San Ysidro and Tijuana even. But anyway, this guy called me and he said, "Hey, Chief, come up here." So I went up and it was a guy by the name of Marvin. I don't know whether Marvin's still living or not yet. He's been a long time ago. He was old then, I thought. He was probably about 40. Well, anyway, Marv called me up, and my hair was down on my collar about like it is now, which is style today, I think. And needless to say, I was just about to shake, you know, the pieces trying to get me something to go on. And Marvin knew a hell of a lot more about me than I knew about me. And he says, "I'm going to do you a favor. So come on in the shop." So I got in the shop, and he scraped off a little beard that I had and clipped my hair. And he says, "I want you to, I'm going to get you a couple of bottles of wine." And, you know, I perked up immediately, you know, damn near well. You know how that goes, you know. And I had never even heard of psychosomatic wellness or illness, but I was damn near well when he promised me those two bottles of wine. I felt adrenaline going through me, and he could have cut the whole goddamn hair or anything else he wanted to. And I would have promised a moon trip as far as that's concerned. But anyway, he said, where do you live? And I told him where I lived. You see, Marvin and I had done a lot of drinking together, and he had disappeared off the street. And naturally, when a wino disappears off the street, you can damn near figure he's dead. In those days, you can almost figure he's dead or he's moved out of town, at least. But Marvin happened to be in business there, and so I promised him that I would go with him that night, him and Ben, to Chula Vista to an AA meeting, but I didn't know what the hell it was because he kept it quiet. He said, I just want you to meet some people, some friends of ours. So naturally, I had this two bottle of wine thing going, so I didn't give a damn where in the hell I was going. You know, I just wanted to shut off the conversation and said, let's get on with it. But anyway, I'd made him a promise, and I didn't have anywhere else to go, so I went home. And that home thing is another story, Al-Anon, if you're ain't in here. But anyway, I went home and nursed those two bottles of wine, and sure enough, about 7:30 at night, there was a knock on the door, and the typical cross the board AA 12 step. So they put me in the car, and I got in the back seat, and they were jabbering in front. And I'm still about half drunk, so I'm jabbering with them. So, not making a whole hell of a lot of sense, I know that. But anyway, I got to, they went to Chula Vista, and they drove in this church. And I knew damn well I was in the wrong place then. I knew something. I wasn't that drunk, you know, I wasn't that stupid. Because in my time, I had sang for my supper a couple of times, and I knew about what these churches do. Then they're trying to save your soul, you know. So we go in this church, and we drive around the back, and we go down in a basement. And this basement was, oh, maybe about half as big as this room is here, and it was almost like an opium den. I've never been in what I've seen pictures of it. And, you know, it was just a blue haze fog in there. So you could hardly see people. And it was the damnedest jabbering that I'd ever heard. I mean, just everybody, just like bees, like it was here at the coffee break. And the biggest thing I noticed was nobody was talking. Nobody was listening. Everybody was talking. You know, so that was my first introduction to you. And that's been 33 years ago this winter. And that was the beginning of a lot of hell. That was the start of a lot of hell there, because it was 7 years more until 1960 that I got sober. As I said before, you know, my life started back in Oklahoma, and it started under a lot of adverse conditions, really, because in those days, the American Indian was treated more or less with the black folks. It was treated as really an inferior people or a minority people. And with the ego and with the pride that I had, it was a continuous fight with somebody. And we were told in our younger days, you know, to not like you people, you white people, because you had done certain things to us. And I really didn't believe that. I mean, for some reason, you hadn't done anything to me. I went to school with you and married you and done the whole damn thing. But I was told that you had done this to the American Indian, so I found that as a pretty good excuse to not like you. And that carried away, and it started something that was to go with me for a long time, and that was hate, and that was anger, and a lot of feelings that one of the persons spoke up here, I think it was Mark or somebody, said something about 16 years or something, even 15 years for his mother's death. But some of those things I didn't know a damn thing about when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that you could repress those things and that they'd pop up later, or that they were the underlying causes for a lot of this stuff. But I did know that I hated, and I did know that I was angered for most of my life. And I could not take any orders from anyone. I could not take authority from family or school teachers or anyone else. And it was just the beginning of an individual personality of a self-will run riot. And I'm sure that you understand what that is. And it starts awful young. It starts awful early. So my life started out, you know, going to high school. And when I was 14, In 1939, I decided I wanted to run away from home. I didn't like what the hell was there, and I knew there was greener pastures someplace, but I wasn't sure where it was. And I had a friend of mine that had been to California, up in Oakey Flats, up above Kernville and Bakersfield in that area where the Okies settled. There were two places that I had heard of that the Okies settled, and one of them was in Long Beach and one of them was in Bakersfield. And sure enough, we made our little trek out to California with I think I had a nickel and a sack of Bull Durham. And we made a decision right there in front of the little depot there in Muskogee, in my hometown. And we made a decision which way we was going, head New York, tails L.A. So tails L.A. won with that one nickel we had. So here we go. We started grabbing freight trains and started doing things that they did in those days. That the story of Woody Guthrie, so to speak, was true. Because these are the kind of people that traveled the roads at that time. And it was an exciting kind of a life. It was exciting as hell because there was always some kind of intrigue. There was always something happening. And any time that we could find a bottle of bay rum or we could run into one of these jungles where they were squeezing a little sterno, we'd join in with them, some of that cheap wine that was selling them for about 15 cents a bottle. So we came to California and started doing things. And Lacey had been, he was pretty well a roadman, I guess you'd say. He'd been traveled quite a bit, and he kind of showed me the ropes. And he was a strong young man. He was really strong. He weighed about 200 pounds, and he was about 5'10". And he really could mug a guy, I tell you that. You know, he was really quick at that kind of thing. So we started going and doing those things, and it seems as though that I didn't know where in the hell I was going. I remember when I got to California, we was sitting up here on the coast someplace, and I sat down and cried. I didn't know what the hell to do. I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to be home. I didn't want to be any place. And in those days, I wasn't really drinking that much, but I was drinking enough. And if you kind of look back in your young adulthood, let's say your adolescence, and you see how it all began. But anyway, that was one of the little things that I started out with. Then the war came along, and I went in the service in the early 40s and done my little bit and came out. And my family, yeah, I blamed them. I blamed Mom. I blamed Dad. I blamed uncles, and I blamed being Indian, and I blamed every damn thing I could think of. And it wasn't necessarily that, because I didn't look at it at that time, but it was the anger, and it was the hate, and it was all those things inside of me that I didn't have a chance to look at. And if you never have a chance to look at those things like we do in AA, you're going to die. It's just about that simple. And as I've learned through the years, that most alcoholics die of this disease because they can't break whatever barrier it is. And that happened to me because I came to you in 1953, and I couldn't get sober. And I started making the rounds of out of here in the psych ward, back in the county psych ward, in the city jail. Old Judge Brennan, I don't know whether some of you guys are old enough to know Judge Brennan. Old Judge Brennan, he was always a friend of mine, you know, because he didn't have to call my name. He just pointed that way, you know, and that was it. And they'd call my name, and Judge would say, there, yeah, take him, there he goes, you know, and things of this sort. Or they'd send me over to county psych ward, and they'd put me on probation, and all of the crap that goes along with living under the conditions. And it was just one of those things that, I guess maybe when you really look at it, that God was very good to me and good to my family in a sense, that whatever he did was out of my control. Through all of the hell that I went through in drinking and hurting people and things of this sort, he seemed fit for me to live, just like he seemed fit for you to live here tonight. Now, this is a privilege, a very much of a privilege. And if you're sitting here with your court cards in your hand, or somebody with a nudge from the judge, or whatever it may be, or what condition you may be, I think maybe you better take some heed to what's happening to you, because it's out there, and a lot of people don't ever make it. A hell of a lot of people don't make it. You're young, you're strong, you're headstrong. And it's natural that you want to control your life. It's natural for any one of us to do it. It's natural for me to want to control my life today. But I have to do something in order to maintain my sobriety. So here's what I'm doing. I don't speak at places. I don't do much talking as far as that's concerned. Occasionally I have a chance to talk, and it does something for me. And that's a selfish little way to look at it, but it does something for me. But anyway, as I started to making the rounds, started making these different institutions, I'd like to give you a little example of something that happened to me back in 1955, somewhere in 56, I came home from on a drunk one time. I came back, let's say, to the house. I can't say it was a home. And my wife has been talking to our neighbor. And she says, and I'm laying back there trying to shake one off in the back room, you know, crawling to the toilet, you know, and missing it half the time and all of this. I heard her say that when my husband was like that, I went to the district attorney. And you know, I know you people right now, so the district attorney, huh? Well, see, my ears went up a little bit more because I knew what the hell our district attorneys were, because I'd been in front of them district attorneys before. So, I'm thinking, well, what she said that the district attorney did was take him out to the county hospital to the psych ward. Well, when she said psych ward, you know, that got damn near got well and got out of there, you know, ready to go. And because I knew that woman of mine would listen, she would damn near listen to anybody to try to do something for me and for the family. Now, she wasn't doing these things to hurt me. She was trying her damnedest to do something to straighten me out, I guess, you know, like most Al-Anons will try to do. You know, they're going to go there to the nth degree trying to save it some way or another. Or save the paycheck, one of the two. To be practical about it. But anyway, what happened was that I didn't pay much attention, you know, and I shook for about 2 or 3 days, and I said, to hell with it. I'm not going to shake anymore, so I start drinking again. Well, I remember this so vividly because it was the All-Star football game was on. I think it was in August. And I had managed to sneak in a couple of bottles in the house, and I stretched out on this old Goodwill couch that I had managed to put in there somewhere or another. And I don't know where in the hell I got this TV. Remember them old TVs? It was about this big, and I thought it was a hell of a thing, you know. It was about 10 or 12 inches, and you just barely could see it, and as far as in it, and the whole bit. But I wanted to watch this ball game. And I was looking at this ball game, and here was a knock on the door. And here was a couple of sheriffs about 9 feet tall standing there. And they had a piece of paper, and they said, Mr. Hendricks, here's a Superior Court order for you to see you out to the county, take you out to the county hospital. And I said, what for? They said, well, just the order, just come with us. Well, I had a bottle back hid back there in the back, and I was going to go back to get my shoes, I told him. And he said, well, I'll go with you. And I couldn't take a drink, so that bottle stayed, naturally. But they took me out there, and they put me stayed out a few days and dried out a little bit, and it wound up that they put me on probation, and wasn't over 6 weeks later, something like that. I went into my probation office and didn't even know him, and he knew me, though. So they sent the man out asking to get me again, so this time they sent me up to Patton City Hospital. And that was a kick. You know, one of the first times I'd ever ventured into one of those state hospitals, which I was to do a little bit more on down the line. And I like to tell this because it tells me, you know, about this omnipotent feeling that I have about myself. You know, sort of like God-like individual. You know, if it can be done, I can do it, and I can do it better than you. So here it was, up in the state hospital, and I was doing my thing up there, and the guy that was in charge of this little cottage, and I called them cottages when there were 350 people in them. And everybody was mixed together. All the hypes and all of the alkies and the nuts were all just mingled, just like if you were here mixed up like this. And we probably got a bunch like that. However, one morning they had what they call shock treatment day. And, see, I got there just after They've done two things to everybody. I got there about a week after they started giving everybody spinal. And then they was giving everybody shock treatments, Alky's nuts and everybody. And that was about the time that Thorazine came in. So, some identification, huh? Well, that's a weird drug, I'll tell you. However, the guy that operated, the attendant that operated this cottage was a fellow Oklahoman. And naturally, we're both horse traders, so we conned each other, and I got a pretty easy little job. I was in the kitchen. I was the overseer of the kitchen. And he says, well, I tell you what, we're short on attendance today, so why don't you walk up to the shock treatment of these guys? And he said, we've got one little black guy here. He says, he always flicks. I said, walk close to him, and if he does, trip him or tackle him or something, we'll take him on up. So just walk close to him. I said, okay. So I went up, and one of the biggest surprises was that they had a number mixed up. Yeah, and they says, so you got eight. Well, I was the eighth one. You see, and the guy said, no, we have seven. He's just come along with us. And man, you know, my heart, goddamn, it jumped out of my throat, you know, because here was a shock treatment. I was scared of what the hell it was going to do, because I'd heard people getting buzzed, you know, and never come back, you know. And so I watched them give shock treatment. And man, I'll tell you, when they'd shoot that juice of these guys, you know, then it was hell. And they had the headaches for a couple of days after. They just let them lay around because of the excruciating headaches these people had. So the reason I was saying this, it always reminds me of of our step two. You know, step one, let's say, is a foregone conclusion in this room today, because if you're an alcoholic and you've taken step one, you have been had. You can believe that. So when you get into two, it speaks of insanity, or speaks of sanity, which is the opposite. So this omnipotent person that you're looking at here tonight was watching them take all this shock treatment. And I had done my 90 days, and there was an attendant there that liked me, and him and his girlfriend were going to Tijuana to party something. So they're going to drop me off in Dago here. But anyway, we got drunk before we got to Rainbow, him and I. And we were really drunk. And she had to drive. And that was the old 395 coming down. And so he poured me out, or she poured me out in front of the house, and it was raining, and here I'm just come out after telling her, you know, that I'm writing letters to her, how I've turned a new leaf, you know, and I've seen the light and all of this shit, you know. And here I am just drunk and the Lord falling in the house and all this. So that lasted, I think, a couple of months. I was just in and out, drinking. And mine got to a point of day and night drinking. I don't know whether you folks have been on an extended wine drunk or not, but by this time I had made myself into a full-blown wino. That's the only thing I could handle with wine. The content of alcohol was just about what I could make it on. Well, anyway, I had to come off of it, naturally. It's one day you have to stop drinking. I don't know, something happens. Either you get too sick or you can't hold it down. Whatever it is. Usually it's so, you're so sick, if you're like me, that you couldn't hold it down. Either that, I had a lot of colitis in those days. There was nothing in me nothing solid. It was all watery. And I was making my cramps to the bathroom, and by the time I got there, it was too late, naturally. So that was one of those things of trying to come off a drunk. And my second day was my day that I had my hallucinations. Usually when I came off of a drunk, about 2 days later is when I started seeing things. And I had a pet, and this pet was a dinosaur. And he was sort of weird looking. He was a weird looking dinosaur because he had baby feet, and he had a horn sticking out of his nose with a little cherub face on it. And it's pretty unusual, yeah. Anyways, it was about 1 o'clock at night, you know, and here I am trying to sleep, and this damn thing started coming into view, and I got to make a set a picture for you, because this little old apartment we lived in, had wood floors, and I had that little TV about this big. I'd gotten it down somewhere down the alley someplace. And it had that old couch that with some of the springs sticking out of it. We covered up with a blanket to make it look a little better. And this was the family situation. That way the family was. So two little kids and a wino and a gal that was a martyr and was trying to save me. So you can imagine what that setting was. Now, at each end of this couch was a couple of old Goodwill lamps. You know, when you're drunk, you always bring something home, you know. You better watch it, too, sometimes. But anyway, this lamp had a bulb hanging out on it. It wouldn't stick straight up because, hell, you know, they threw it away. They didn't want it, so the bulb just laid down. The reason I'm saying this is because now I'm a smart dude, you know. I'm thinking, I'm figuring things out, which I always did in my life. I always figured things out. And that's what got me here, in fact. So I'm looking at this dinosaur, you know, and I don't want to see this dinosaur, so I figured, you know, this thing started to work. And this little light bulb came on up here and says, idea. And what's the idea? Well, the idea was if they chopped those nuts out of that the limb they were in up there in Patton, a little juice might kind of straighten me up a little bit. Well, I'll get through this dinosaur. And see, I'm thinking straight. You know, I mean, this is... And this is the way it is. So I pondered a while. I was hoping that I didn't pee on that couch where it electrocuted me if I had. So I sat there a while and I said, well, here goes. So I scooted over on the end of the couch and I took the bulb out. And it didn't take too much nerve because I'd already figured it out, you know, what the hell. So I reached in there and I touched that, put my finger in that socket and it immediately jumped straight up, you know. Straight up in the air. Hair and all, you know. And I would guess that the wife, you know, she'd heard so much crap going in that front room because I never slept with her, you know. So she couldn't stand me because if you guys know what a drunk couch is, well, you know there's nobody going to be around it. Even the cat won't even lay on it. Well, anyway, 10 minutes or so went away. I laid down, you know, and I'm thinking, well, it's gone. So, success. Yeah. However, in about 10 minutes, here comes that dinosaur back, you know. And so I had to give myself some more juice, you know, thinking again, if I go a little bit longer, I'll be all right. But it didn't work. It didn't work. I didn't know that it just took time. Just plain old time. That's all it was that it took. But it was a failure again. Now, I knew what a failure was because I'd lived a failure. So the reason I brought this in was that it's kind of humorous, but it's the way that alcoholics operate. It's the way this alcoholic operated. And when I got to the program to start working the program, I always remember about step two and how smart that I really thought I was. And just like you in this room, the only thing you have to do is just ask one of us and we'll tell you. You know, it doesn't take much either. You can talk about some politics or the space lab or whatever you want to do. And everybody in this room knows all about it, you know. Anyway, as this went along and as time went along, up towards 1959, the family broke up and, she moved to Riverside, and I was still here in San Diego. And I was going through the remorseful thing of the children. I mean, the really remorseful thing. And I was willing to do damn near anything just to be back with the kids. Because I knew that I didn't care for this woman, but I didn't care for anybody. At that stage of the game, I didn't give a damn about anybody, but especially me. And if I didn't care for me, I didn't care for you. So we went back together for a few months. in the winter of 59. And I didn't stay sober. In fact, I was doing something weird. You know, I was riding the Greyhound bus down 395 to come down here to draw my rocking chair money, in fact, the unemployment down to San Diego. And I'd get a bottle of wine one way and I'd get another bottle going back. Just enough to have a drink on each week. So the time run out as time went along. In the early part of 1960, I went back to AA there in Riverside. And I don't know. It was the only place I had to go. That was all that was left. And I guess I'd have went somewhere else if I thought maybe I could have. I guess it's probably to a point then of near death, or near suicide or something. But anyway, I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous and stayed for a few months until November. Then my mother died back in Oklahoma. I had two deaths within a month's time, back in one in Dallas and one in Oklahoma. And I had a few months of sobriety, a few months of being dry. And I thought I had a hold of something. I really did. I thought I was able to go back and face all of this traumatic thing, you know, without having to kill myself or screw things up, which I did anyway. And that was my last drunk in the 11th of November, 1960. And from there on, the program had to be worked. Now I came back to you folks, and I came back from Oklahoma, and it was a matter of life or death now. Because things were starting to happen here that didn't happen there before. And I was getting scared. I was getting scared that maybe I was one of those constitutionally incapable people of being honest with myself, which I was up until that time. I had no idea what the psychology of this program was. I had no idea what the depth of this program was. I just thought, well, maybe when I quit drinking, you know, everything would be okay. I didn't know it was only the beginning of a life and then the way to live. Well, there was some conflict in this whole thing. The biggest conflict was the religion that I was raised in. You see, I was married to a Seventh-day Adventist nurse, and I was raised in Seventh-day Adventist church schools when I was younger. And they'd done a good job on me. They'd done a lot of value-setting type things. They'd done a lot of religious type things, a lot of tyrannies, in other words. Something that I could not follow. No matter what, I can't follow them today, and I haven't been to any type of an organized religious church. I don't know, I don't feel guilty about it, so I haven't been pushing it. And I don't really look for any future that I'm going to church even. I won't say that. But the point being was that somewhere along the line, somebody had struck me with something that was, I cursed it for a long time, and that was values. I had a value system. And you folks in this room have a value system, or you wouldn't be here tonight. You care. That's the rub of it. You care. I cared. But my behavior was in constant battle with my values. Therefore, I was doing sinning all the time. And I could not blot out the sinning any longer. And you know what that type of life will lead to. You know, you've got to obliterate it some way or another, and you can't do it. So, after I came back from Oklahoma, I was drinking there in Riverside for a couple of days, and that was the time when you came to bat, I guess you'd say, as Alcoholics Anonymous members. There were four or five guys that loved me more than I loved myself. They took me under hand, and they towed me around Riverside, and just literally wore me out. Literally wore me out. They wouldn't let me sleep, because they knew that I wouldn't sleep very long. And finally come detox, as the people, you know, what we have today is all of these different treatment centers, detoxification centers, and all of these, the different modern ways, I guess it is, to go through that thing. And I don't knock those, because sometimes you won't come through those detox periods by yourself. So it only just begun then. So I got sober, but I had this conflict. And I was going through a lot of hell because I could not differentiate between religion in my mind and spirituality. And I didn't have anybody there that would really explain spirituality to me. And I knew it had to do something with me inside, but I didn't know quite what. So one night, in order to kind of to expedite a little bit, one night I was it was after a meeting about 10 o'clock, and it was really there was no moon. And out by Lake Matthews in Riverside County, there's this little hill that I used to go up to meditate and go out there on Sunday afternoons every now and then, shoot 10 cans of the 22 and things of this sort. So I knew where this place was. So I went back to the three pertinent steps that God could and would if He was sought. And so I made this effort to do something about making some conscious contact with a power greater than myself, or God, whatever you want to call it. But I had been taught that it was God, so I gave Him the name of God. So I went up on this mountain, and I was in charge of a big construction crew up there at the time, and I went after this meeting, and we had a big concrete pour at 6 o'clock the next morning. And I stayed up there, it was in the summertime, and I stayed up there until about 4:30, something like that. And I came down, and while I was up there, there was something happened. And it wasn't a real traumatic type thing. It was just something happened. And I was talking to God, as I understood Him. And the night was balmy. It was about 90 degrees, 85 or 90 degrees. And the air was just beautiful. And it was so clear. And the stars were just like you could reach up and touch them. And I was out on the hood of the car and sitting there just laying back. And something happened to me. And I don't know what it is today, other than the fact that God works in mysterious ways. Very mysterious ways. And He became a buddy. Now, He wasn't this wrathful God. He wasn't the God that I was taught He was. And as an adult, I'm thinking, well, why in the hell should I be believing this kind of thing at this stage of the game, as old as I am? So I came down from there feeling good. I came from down there feeling secure that something had happened. So I went to work that day, and I started telling people about what happened. And I started making more of a conscious contact. I started doing something that's been done for most of my life, and that's saying something to God in the morning and something at night about where I am and my ability to function. That I need your help, and I'm willing to do the footwork. Little did I know that the footwork was hell. Sometimes I look back at my career as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know whether I'd go through it again or not. But I guess I would, I know. The reason I was saying a while ago that I had to get into the steps, because I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, social meetings, would not keep me sober. And there's a lot of social meetings like this all over. See, I go to get a kick out of what a speaker. I don't ever get much out of what a speaker says. Very seldom. I go to see old friends, and I go to laugh and to have fun. But I really don't care too much for speaker meetings, other than the fact that I walk away from them sober when I'm participating. So when they got into the steps, and I had to look at the first step again. And it got to a point to where that I really didn't understand what it meant by this unmanageable life until somebody broke the word powerless down. Then it's related to my life, and it showed just exactly where the hell it really was, that I was actually powerless in my life to anything, drunk, sober, or whenever. Then started going through the steps. When I got to step four, and for some unknown reason, like a lot of you folks in this room, I had one hang-up against step four. I guess maybe because I thought I had done a lot of things that you hadn't did. So the thing was that I was scared of it. And I went for 30 months before I took the fourth and fifth step. And I don't really advocate that to anyone in this room, because that's a long time, I'll tell you. And I was going through probably the damnedest dry drunk that I'd ever been on. I didn't want to drink, but I wasn't going anywhere. I guess I was going someplace, too. I was going backwards. So here's what happened along that course. For the first time in my life, I started to thinking about suicide. And maybe that you're in that predicament tonight, some of you. Maybe you're in that dry drunk and you're scared to take the fourth and fifth step. We have many, many people. If you think about the power in this room right now as far as someone taking the fourth and fifth step, we've got all the power that we need within one AA group. We don't have to go anywhere else. We can do it right here as far as this group is concerned. And each one of us would help a person go through these things if you just ask. And if you got in the predicament that I was, you had to ask. But there's old timers in this thing that I'm so ever grateful for. Very, very grateful that we have old time people in this thing. And you read in the 12 of 12 about interceptions about some of the old timers, some of the bleeding deacons and guys that really, I guess they're considered the backbone of the whole thing. And they're dying out slow. Us old farts are dying out as we go out the other end. And all you young people are coming up the other way. So, as I looked at this thing, there was an old timer that I liked very well there in Riverside. And he came into the club one day. We both got off work about the same time. And he worked at another place. And he came in with a legal pad and a bunch of golf pencils. I'm a golfer. And he brought them in, he used to, and he threw them on the table, and he said, "Here, you Indian son of a bitch," he said, "you better get to writing before you blow your head off." And that's the kind of language I understand. See? That's the way I am. And there's a man-to-man talking to a man, so he made an impression on me. But I often wondered, how in the hell does he know? You know, how in the hell does he know that I've even thought about this? So I had never in my life thought about killing myself. I mean, in all of the hell that I'd been through, I'd never thought about killing myself until this happened. I had contemplated doing away with a couple of people, but I had not thought about it being me. So I wrote my fourth step. It took me a while to do that. And I took it to him, and I forced it on him. I said, "You son of a bitch," I said, "you put it on me, so now you've got to listen it out." And he went through a lot of stuff in between the lines. He read in between the lines because he knew me so well. And some of the stuff I started hedging on, he wouldn't let me hedge. Now, you may have a sponsor like that, or you may have somebody that you take that fourth step with, a fifth step with, and I would advocate that. You know, if somebody says you can meet somebody on the street and take it, I don't believe in that stuff. I mean, if you're going to get in this damn thing, get into it. Get into it to where it really counts. But it opened up a whole lot of things, and then on it really, really went to work. Because I didn't really see what it said in that 12 by 12, and it says, step 6 says this separates the men from the boys. And I'm thinking, what the hell does those first five do, you know? and to know, as you look at them today, if you've been to very many good 12-step study groups, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you work those things out, you work them methodically out, and you don't read them. I've been in groups 12 by 12 where you read them, and somebody goes into a drunk log. And I'm thinking, what in the hell's going on here? They call it a step study group, and they're not doing a damn thing, but talking about the refrigerator wouldn't work today or something. But anyway, the program started to roll. It started to go, and I started to find out some of the things, especially in the spirituality thing, because this buddy of mine was still hanging tough with me. And it became a friend. It became like a person that would be just a friend of yours. That would love you under any condition. It means if you do something wrong, he still loves you. If you do something good, he still loves you. But he gives me one of the things, what I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not going to keep you here over a couple of minutes anyway. So we started a little bit late, so you're going to have to bear to get out one or the other. So the thing that happened to me was that as I got into these steps and I started working these steps, I started finding out things, you know, that I had repressed so far back. And as this calibrator and myself started working in my life, I found out that I was getting some, what our book calls, tangible results. I started getting something that I could see, touch, and feel. And I went for a long time on your sobriety. Some of you guys may be like that in here. I went a long time on your sobriety. I used to call it apron string sobriety, and that won't last too damn long unless you're just lucky as hell, because you got to work this program. But what it gives me, and this is something I think that most alcoholics that I have ever run into, and I run into thousands of them, it gives me dignity, and it gives me self-worth. It gives me something that makes me feel good about me, and in turn, it makes me feel good about you. So the thing of, you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous quite often, especially with new people, how do you know whether it's God's will or my will? Well, just think about this. Why'd you ask the question? You see? Think it through. Why'd you ask the question? It's usually because you are wanting to make some decision in your favor. Yeah. Now, that's the way I look at it. Because that's the way I am, and I, you know, you get a garden variety type wino, what the hell, we're damn near alike anyway. So the only thing that happens to us any different is that you drink at a different place, a different age, a different time. That's about all. I remember old Chuck used to say that if you want to get a typical alcoholic, that if you had a sack big enough to put us all in, all you had to do is reach in there and get one, and you had it. Yeah. And that's reading the trust that's worked for us. But anyway, let's get into a little bit, 5 minutes or so, and I'll tell you what it is today. I'd like to say something about my wife, because this is kind of funny. To you guys that are macho, you know, you're really macho. That, I had made a vow, you know, that never but never would I marry an alcoholic woman. Never. But I knew alcoholic women. And to cap it off, I'd never marry an alcoholic woman with somebody else's kids, because my old man used to say that. Raise your own goddamn kids, you know. Well, I'd lost one family, so I didn't have that opportunity, but I did have the opportunity when I met Penny. And we've been married 18 years now. We've known each other for 20. And that was the never say never. You know, and so there's my never say never. So if you got that in mind, that's a hard thing to say, that you never say never, because somebody's going to make you eat those words sometime. Now, today's life, I work in a recovery home, a big one. We have about 140 bed men and women type thing up in Santa Ana. And I have 90 guys that I work with, about seven groups a week, doing the big book and doing the 12 by 12. And I'll tell you what, since I've been there a year with these folks, I was working in industry before. I've been a year with those folks, but I'll tell you what it's done to me. And God does work in mysterious ways. Working with those guys makes me work my program. You know what I'm saying? Because it comes home, starting with step one, getting back to this thing of admitting it's powerless over alcohol. Because as you go along, you got to think about time healing a lot of wounds. But anyway, the life today is great. It gives me an opportunity today to live. Notwithstanding the fact that we butt heads every now and then. She's a pretty strong opinionated person. And I am too. But I've learned to do a lot of things by telling some of the other people what to do. You ever do that? You know, walk like you talk, mother, you know. So when I am wrong, I have to promptly admit it. Because I cannot hold any kind of resentment or grudge for 10 minutes. I just cannot do it. If I start doing it, man, it starts to boil in my gut, and pretty soon I cut the line of communication. And when I cut the line of communication, the communication gap opens because that other person don't want the communication either. So here you go. So when you're living with someone, you've been married to them, and you love them, and you want to be with them, the harmony of it is that you have the tools today to bring this thing back by eating a little crow. All you've got to say is, let's sit down and talk, honey, because I don't want to feel like I'm feeling, and I know you don't. So let's get the thing out here and talk about it. And it saved a lot of hell, I'll tell you. Not saying there would be divorce or anything of this sort, but it was saying that we would live in discomfort. And I can't stand living uncomfortable. And that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a way to live comfortable. It's not a big and grand and glorious thing. You know, I'm not doing anything more than I've been supposed to have been doing for almost 26 years anyway. November 11 will be my 26th birthday. But I got another one I don't like to mention in October. You see? But I don't really give a damn anymore, you know. I think I went through a period there where age was a factor. But it doesn't make that much difference anymore. And as time goes along, and somebody spoke about character defects, as time goes along, it seems like the character defects and all of these things that were so extremely significant to me before seem to be turning a little bit grayer as time goes along. A lot of things are not as important today as they used to be. But the most important thing to me in my life today is be able to do something for another drunk. And I have been doing this thing for quite a while. And it seems as though the job has been awful good to me in that fact. And one of the things that when I jump up in the morning, we have our little prayer session between us. And I'm grateful for being sober first. And I'm grateful for being healthy. I didn't think so when I played that south course at Torrey Pines today. And I walk when I play golf. And I was dragging ass about 17, I'll tell you. But it wasn't a mental tiredness. It wasn't one of those tiredness that you have with anger and hate and disgust. And it was just a good tiredness, a physical tiredness. But anyway, the privilege of coming down here, and I'm going to congratulate all you birthday people, and Claudia for asking me to come down, and for your attention. See, it means a lot to me. It means a lot to feel good with you. And that's what it's all about. And I may say something, I might have said something here tonight that might have helped you. And I hope so. However, if I didn't, there's one thing that I said that helped me, you know, and that's the only thing that counts, because I'm a very selfish person as far as this sobriety is concerned. And who would have told me that a little over 25 years ago that I would make a trip to San Diego to talk to a bunch of drunks, you know? No, never, never. Man, I wouldn't waste my time on you, you know? But now it's part of my life, and I hope that it'll be part of your life. So it's a hell of a way to go. So for anybody that's newer than I or that's new tonight, there's probably one of the things that I like to say most to anyone. And it's corny as hell. It's corny as hell, but it's been going for now for 50 years or so. How H-O-W, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And it's still the basic training that we had many years ago. And it continues to work. So the thing that I'm saying to you tonight, if you're new, give yourself that break. Because it's probably, and it could be your last break. So with that, I thank you for your attention, and I thank the committee for asking me down here.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.